Hi, you're listening to Secrets for an Inspirational Life with me, your host, Mimi Novick. I'm so happy and thrilled to have you here with me. I have created this series for all of us so we can change our world together and live a more holistic and balanced life. Together, we will share lots of inspiring stories from all walks of life, speak with leading experts, enjoy healthy living ideas, explore music and subjects that inspire each other to always have hope. Thank you so much for listening. I really appreciate all of you. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Secrets for an Inspirational Life. How are you all? I hope that life is treating you well. I hope that there are more beautiful moments than sad moments. But then I say to myself, and I remind myself, that unless there was darkness, we could never see the light. And unless that darkness enveloped us at some point in our life, we could never really show others the path towards the light. And it's something that I hold very dear to me. We all go through things in life that are difficult. Some of us, some people out there, some of you out there will have experienced things where you have thought that you can never come back from the edge, that life is too sad and too sorrowful. But really, I'm here to remind you, along with my wonderful guests, that life really does go on. Maybe not in the same way as we had imagined, but incredibly so. We have this innate strength, every single one of us, that propels us towards a greater good, to make this world really, truly something that is good, something that is better. And that can only happen if we ourselves can illuminate that light within us. Now, I am absolutely delighted to welcome my special guest today, who is the very interesting and very lovely Kevin Silas. Kevin is a martial arts sensei and well-being expert who has traveled across the globe for over 35 years, teaching his unique techniques. They include yoga, meditation, breath work, and rebalancing work, to name but a few. He is a 6th Dan kickboxing champion and 2nd Dan jiu-jitsu. His own life has been a testing ground, one which has led him to embrace a life dedicated to helping others reveal their own true path. He describes his work as helping others move into the more deeper aspects of themselves and the world around them. His expertise in these sacred methods means that he is able to assist his clients to access healing and to release deep trauma. Today, he shares his journey. Welcome, dear Kevin.
Hi there, how you doing?
Hello. How are you today?
Yeah, all's good. All's good today.
How are things in your world today, Kevin? Is the rain, has it reached you? Or are you still enjoying sunny moments?
No, the rain has fallen heavy today, but that's okay. It's all good. You know, you just get
that's
on
with how
you.
Life is, isn't that's it? A little sunshine, a little rain.
Yeah, it's all good.
It's all good. Thank you so much for joining me. And, you know, I have been, what I have to say to the people out there, I have been trying to cajole Kevin to come for ages, and finally now we have the pleasure of his company. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, Kevin, let's start somewhere. You have led a very, very interesting, varied, colourful life. And before you came into all of these wonderful things that you do, traveling, all your different interests, because I know that Kevin also is a singer and a songwriter and all sorts of things, as well as being a well-being expert. Let's go back. Tell us a little bit about where all of this journey began.
Briefly, grew up in an Irish Catholic household with there were five of us children. I was the youngest of the five. We had a very back in those days, very impoverished upbringing. Very, very tough at times. We struggled from time to time. Sometimes food was scarce, sometimes teaching, sometimes getting through the day was a task for all of us. And like a lot of people experience through those difficulties, parents had a hard time. They separated. And it kind of like, there were lots of challenges there. There was addictions and struggles with the parents, both. So, so through that, already a challenge to ask yourself certain questions or look at life because of circumstances in a different way. You kind of have to be able to surf those kind of circumstances, so that was where it was at the beginning. For me, it was music first and foremost. Now, we lived in a very, very like I mentioned, impoverished circumstances, extremely so. But my interest in music was everything from a very, very young age. I still am I couldn't get through the day without listening to particular types of music that have messages of inspiration and, bringing up the energy or even lowering the frequency of your energy so that you can be in a different space. And allow that to heal you. Allow that to allow you to venture into your imagination. Because from that is, for me, springs everything, insight, dreams, intuition. And many, many, many other facets of what we all are, what we all possess, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And when I think about I've spoken to a lot of people about the power of music as a mode of healing, yes. And including myself, it's something that even as a child, it was my go-to place. It doesn't matter whether I was feeling rubbish at the time or if I was feeling lonely or happy or joyful or sorrowful. It would be the place that I would go, and somehow it would speak the words that I didn't have the courage to say.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I think that's why it was like a first stage of learning, and also expansiveness. And I was lucky because my eldest sister moved a boyfriend into our circumstances. And in amongst all a lot of chaos and what have you, this particular boyfriend, when I was about nine, brought with him a massive record collection, albums at the time, and he had a fantastic stereo. So he moved in, set it all up, headphones a lot, and it was way out of my remit at that time. But I had access to that, so he introduced me to a whole array of music that just wasn't available at that time. I'm not talking radio music, talking music like you know, that would just take you somewhere else. And so I was really, like yourself, I took refuge in that. And and then, of course, you know, music, they'd mentioned authors, they'd mentioned writers, and all of that, which later on would have an influence on you. You would seek out the artists and the writers that other artists and writers are referring to in songs, such as David Bowie or early Led Zeppelin. And I'm talking about 1973, when I was really young. I just was consumed by that, taken away from the mainstream and introduced to something that was just, you know, mind-blowing to a nine-year-old's ears, you know. Really, really grateful for that. I think personally, that had a major, major play in what I would then come to want to study later, you know, in my life. And, there's a great term called under council estate skies. A lot of kids from where I came from, and I found out later, you know, a lot of artists and musicians and writers and what have you that came from under council estate skies, there wasn't much going on for us. You know, there were street corners, blinking lamplights, and not much else, you know. But along comes, you know, you go home, and in amongst all that kind of bleakness, you have like artists like David Bowie talking about different horizons and experiences and what have you, and other artists, you know, and so yeah, they help you kind of like formulate a kind of almost like a way out eventually, you know. They sow the seed that something's possible, you know, there's a way out. And so for that,
it is a magical, a otherworldly, a spiritual way with music. And not a day goes by for me, I don't know about you, Kevin, but it's my life. I don't know what I would actually do if there was no more music, because it's so ingrained inside of me. But I do feel that actually it's ingrained in all of us.
Yeah, it's almost like it's in that DNA code. I mean, it comes ancestral past, doesn't it? I mean, music is where, you know, music was the first kind of language, rhythm, and you know, syncopation, and also the space in between that made also music, playing music as well. Understanding a little bit about music, also understanding then, you know, the nuance of music, the emotion of it, what it can set you to, how it can inspire you. And also the creation of music, you need space in between. You need space in between the notes. That sounds kind of like pretentious, but when you really understand that or appreciate it, without space, without the nothingness, there can be nothing formulated or created. So that comes to fruition with the study of Buddhism and Hinduism and Zen Buddhism in particular, you know, where the appreciation of the nothingness or the space. The space is the potential for all things, you know? Yeah. Out of that mystery comes everything that recognizes being creative, you know? Everything. So that's one way that can help for me, I find that helps with anxiety, and it helps with, you know, states where you kind of like feel like you're overwhelmed. That silence, that space, the meditation of it, the contemplation is where, you know, not to give up hope, because in the West we have like a linear way of thinking. Sounds a bit cliche, but we do. In the East, traditionally, it's a circular way of thinking. So the balance is really important there. The balance between the nothingness and the something. This is what we need to kind of find how to bring about in ourselves and understand that, you know, and experience it, not just understand it, but experience it. So nothingness to a Zen master is everything, if that makes sense. So if you can just change your perspective slightly on that, that's what I mean. It can assist you in when you're feeling kind of lost, or you're feeling a little bit, out of sync or misaligned, that can bring you back to appreciating that, yeah, of course, the foreground, the background. Can't have one without the other. And I think, in a secular way, we've spent many, many hundreds of years trying to eradicate and also extract ourselves from that, which causes us even more pain and suffering, if that makes sense. That's clear.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to go back to the music aspect, several things were coming to me as you were speaking. Somehow the music is that freedom. So yeah. Whether, however difficult someone's life is or childhood was, there are scars that are left in everyone's life through things that they have been through. Yeah. And the music is a freedom. It's a bridge, really, towards other spheres, towards other realities and realms that gives that safe place. And it's one of the most powerful mediums that can be used either, I think, these days especially, leaves a lot to be said for some of the so-called music that can become an entrapment, which I've seen for so many people that suffer, that lead a life that is somehow controlled by this so-called music. Yeah. I've seen it a lot in young people, and they are somehow led along a very, very dubious path. So that's why it's such a powerful medium. And then you've got the other side of it, where it can be a total enlightenment. For example, whether it be the Buddhists, the chanting, the Sufis with their chanting, whatever you know, belief system you have, whatever mantras that they're repeating, it is really a connection with the divine.
It is, yeah. Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah, and hopefully, if you're lucky enough or fortunate enough, that will set that little spark off in you. And yeah, life's never the same. That's how important music is. And I agree, it's so powerful, it's so influential, it can be used in detrimental fashion. And totally, it's hypnotic, isn't it?
Yes.
It's one of its qualities. Yeah, you then, I also think great music to the individual, whatever that is. Kind of like, don't have a choice. It takes you. And if you can stay conscious and aware, like you touched on, that's where your inner worlds open up. That's where your potential opens up. That's when other realms reveal themselves. When I say other realms, to me, they're just as real as the realm we're in at the moment, however real that is, because we know that that's up for questioning all the time as well. So So
that's absolutely right, what you've just said, because we believe sometimes, especially in the West, that this is the only life, that this is the only world.
Yeah.
What we see with our eyes is the reality.
Yeah.
But in fact, the reality is within us, and it's what's within us that actually we project onto the world.
Absolutely.
There's a great secret, I think, in that, that, you know, there's that famous saying, we don't see things as they are, but as we are.
Yes.
And I really believe that, because the time now is that it's so close, the veil between the worlds of spirituality, of the earthly physical world, that is being tested to the maximum.
I think
And what are we going to do? Are we going to remain chained to this world? Or are we actually going to up our game and lift that veil?
Yeah, I totally agree. I just feel, my experiences recently over the last few years in particular, like you said, are bringing us to a point where I think for want of a better term, but I think it's time that we need to find a spiritual path, because I think we are going to be tested in many ways, unexpected ways. It's all good. We are waking up to our true potential. Our true potential, our luminosity, our own intrinsic wisdom is going to be ignited. And some people may not be too up for that, and they may not feel they're equipped for that. On the other hand, every spiritual path requires that from us. From the initiates in the mystery schools back to Egypt and beyond, to American Indians, to the samurai, to the Sufis, and to the yogis. You know, that's the challenge. That was the challenge, you know, where angels fear to tread.
Yes.
From the tests of Shiva, he's, you know, from Krishna, and all of them, you know, it's the same maxim, you know.
Mm.
How are you going to respond? It's the ball's in your court. From, again, Western mystics as well, from, you know, Gurdjieff and what have you. They were teaching the same teachings. I'm quite, for my upbringing, one thing I did acquire, and for my DNA, from my ancestry, was you have to stand your ground. You have to stand your ground sometimes. Yes, you have to acquiesce. You have to learn how to go with the flow, which you can't be anything other than the flow. But you also sometimes need to stand your ground. In a spiritual sense, that's what that means. You know, the yogi, everybody's got this. I'm going to say not everybody, but there's a blanket view of yoga now. It's just become nice. It's just become a nice pastime. You know, the yogis of yesteryear, and there are still a few around on this planet right now. Hmm. One, you have to find them. Two, it's no easy matter to sit at the feet of an awakened teacher. That's, you know, we imagine that now we're used to lights and fanfare and, you know, beautiful studios. You know, most yogis are still in the forest or in the mountains on the pool. You find them. And I'd imagine that if you were to sit opposite them, there's no questions to ask. You think you have a whole textbook, imagine, of questions you're going to ask these people. And when you sit at their feet, there's nothing to ask. There's just experience to be with them. Do you see what I'm saying? They're teaching
100%.
Yeah, they're teaching beyond that discursive, that intellectual mind. You need that for the first few rungs. Of course you do. And you need it to be discerning. And you don't want to go in with just blind faith. But at the same time, yeah, all the schools require of the student a particular grounding and an initiation. So that's not new. And I think music prepares you for that. Even if you know it, you don't know it. If it means that much to you, if it inspires your whole existence, literally to the atomic, then you know that on your deepest core, in your deepest core, in your deepest level, you know that. You know that requirement. And so, that leads on to why often people ask me, how do I marry the two disciplines of yoga and martial arts? I get that asked all the time. You know?
That's a very interesting combination.
Yeah, it's loads of people over the years give me this perplexed look. My simple answer to that would be: life requires of us to be one. Sometimes, like I said, you stand your ground. Standing your ground, as far as I'm concerned, in its realist aspect, is to know what's expected of a warrior. When the Bushido code of honor. That's from the samurai school and many other martial arts traditions from across the globe. I have no problem with that. To acquire the skills and the strength, determination, courage, fortitude, and not putting yourself first, if the case may, if the case or the situation may arise, I see it as an honor, like the samurai did, and it's been lambasted recently in these last few years. Everything about that is just thrown into being like masculine, toxic, being a toxic masculinity, and all these terms which mean nothing to me. My life taught me that, like I said earlier, that one has to stand their ground sometimes, and that's just the way it is. One is polite, one is intelligent, one uses their skills to converse, to talk the way out of a situation, even in your life situation. But you keep it in your back pocket, the skills that you acquire, that you've acquired through your practice of martial arts, you know. So yoga and martial arts for me are the same path. One just is, you know, it's the same destination. Two different paths, the same destination, is to arrive at wisdom, peace, and learning. And then to maybe perhaps impart some of that to other people that are interested, you know. But this is the same path as far as I'm concerned. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And I totally agree with you. And someone once said to me, and I know there's different versions of this, but the only version that I remember is be gentle, but carry a big stick.
Yeah.
And I think you've got to know when to be what.
When to be what? And that goes hand in hand with the acquisition of wisdom then, doesn't it? Because again, people with lack of understanding of either field of yoga or spheres of yoga and martial arts, when they ask me that question, it's like, well, have you studied martial arts for a long time? Have you studied yoga for a long time? The answer, most of the time, would be no. Well, then, study both. Come back to me in 15 years' time, and then you ask me that question again. You probably won't ask me it anymore. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I understand.
Because it reveals
what you're saying.
Yeah, it reveals itself to the participant, to the practitioner. The answers reveal themselves, and so. Society that undervalues these principles, like I said earlier, honor and courage and wisdom in all of us is a lesser society as far as I'm concerned. It just for me, it goes hand in hand with the sitting upright of the great yogi and the skill and the intelligence of samurai warrior and many other warriors, you know. And I think we're lacking that in our society. It's not giving people a structure or initiation or the opportunity to understand what it truly means to face their shadow, if that makes sense, and work with that, you know?
Because people are afraid of their own shadow. This is the thing. And we all have moments in our life where we don't want to see that dark part, but it's inevitable because there's good and bad, there's dark, there's light, and it's all part of the same circle, in fact.
It's all on the same spectrum, yes, and it can't be separated, like we touched on earlier. The beauty of the Japanese, and well, I might say Taoist philosophy first, I think that influenced Japanese for a bit later, but yeah, all of that and the Tao Te Ching is one of probably the most profound, literary pieces on mysticism that's ever been, and that massive influence on martial artists all across the globe again, and has been for many years, and philosophers and what have you. Understanding balance, isn't it? It's bringing into harmony balance. The middle way, how to yield, when to yield.
So it's really, when I think about life and the way of the world now, Kevin, I see there is no balance. There must be a greater, far greater balance occurring, of course, because it's all meant to be as it's playing out. But people have become extreme.
Yeah.
And everything is extreme. Extreme loneliness, extreme rudeness, extreme misunderstanding. Everything is extreme, and everything is, you and I have spoken about this many times. It's the me show, where everybody wants a photograph of themselves on the wall and to adore it. How did that, I'm always curious, and I don't have the answer, I'm not wise enough for that. Where did that flip, do you think, happened, where people just became, not everyone, of course, but society, became so self-obsessed? What happened? Do you think it was the internet? Is it as simple as that? What happened? Because I don't know. I've thought about this a lot, this question. What happened where suddenly nobody cares? I'm being very, very now rational. You know, it's a blanket thing that I'm saying now.
Great statement.
Yeah, it's a bit maybe even extreme in what I'm saying. But the majority of people out there are suffering. And I see the suffering because there's a disconnection with other people. Because if you're so self-obsessed with yourself, because of course we've got to look after ourselves, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about something completely different. If you are so disconnected to everything in nature, everybody around you, and you are constantly looking for admiration, and you want someone to praise you every day. This is a long road to hell. I'm really not exaggerating, because you'll never be satisfied. What happened? Where did it all go wrong?
Wow, that's a massive question, isn't it? Maybe you know.
But I'm interested in what on your thoughts.
My thoughts. I think we took a quantum leap into the unknown, and I think we're heading fast into, we're speeding up faster into the unknown. I don't think we're qualified. I don't think we've taken our wisdom with us. I don't think we've taken our balance with us in many respects. With this internet and the onset of it, the accessibility to be anywhere, everywhere, at the press of a button, and this kind of like over need for validation all the time, like you said, is quite upsetting, and is as in like globally upsetting. I don't think it's good for any of us. We're now confirming ourselves through the opinions of like literally millions of others, and I think yoga in particular is suffering badly because of it. As a discipline, as a practice, as a heart movement, as a means of bringing about peace and wisdom into your mind and your heart and your body and balance again. It somehow doesn't sit right with this internet world. It just doesn't. Our disassociation from, you know, we say the natural world. We don't no longer, most people no longer take a moment out to go and listen to the unspoken language of, for instance, animals, to our own severe detriment. That's just my take on things. Every day I try and get out with my best friend. My best friend's my dog. I walk him every day. He's my best friend. I love him to death. They are like natural yogis, you know. They need so little, and yet they're so appreciative of what they get. So for him and me to take off, we take off at nighttime, late at night. We have a different language. We hear a different language. We sense a different world. The
what
animals,
type of dog is it?
My little one is he's of the bully breed, which is not very popular at the moment. But he's well trained. He's disciplined.
Of the what breed?
He's of a bully breed, like a Staffordshire Bull Terrier. You know.
Ah, okay, okay.
He's a little beauty, and he's loyal. He's like I say, he's friendly. He's well trained. He's beautiful. And so him and me, we go off on little adventures every day. I've done that since I was a child. I've always had dogs, and they've always been my, you know, closest companions when things were really difficult at home. when they were falling apart, I'd take my dog out for literally for hours at nighttime, and we'd go. So I've done that most of my life when I could have a dog. Mm. I loved them as companions. But I think the relationship to the natural world, we're talking about actually at this moment, lots of media coverage on climate change and fossil fuels and what have you. Let's not get into that. But let's not get into that. But that doesn't, for me, answer and resolve the deeper soul need to get back to relating to and respecting and honoring again all living things. I know that sounds, unrealistic, but one has to practice these things, you know. The importance of that is really underestimated, and the value of that is underestimated, and the mental health aspects of that, especially for children, are underestimated. And as we watch more and more of our natural world just disappear under concrete and false lighting and what have you, motorways and what have you, we're just watching it being consumed. Hmm. For me, pretty much like the American Indians saw their land. Every time a field disappears, it breaks a little bit of your heart. That's how in touch we should be. That's my take on it.
I agree. Because even when I see trees being felled, I went to the woods a couple of months ago to a particular woods that I love, and they were chopping the trees down. And these trees, Kevin, were literally hundreds of years old. They were pine trees. Yeah. I was distraught. I cannot handle when they cut down trees.
Yeah.
And this is the point, what you said. You have to become aware of every living thing. That's what's going to save humanity.
It is going to save humanity, and we do need to take that quantum leap. I think that's our challenge. And I think
no one's talking about saving humanity. You can't save planets unless you save humanity.
Yeah, you can't. And you can't save humanity without including all living things, because we are here because of them, and we're interlinked. And their consciousness, like trees, for instance, you know, it sounds like tree hugging. You can hug a tree because you get energy from them. You can walk on the earth because you get energy from them every day. You can also garner inspiration and wisdom from animals. You know, listen intently, go to their level. I'm not saying that they'll speak to you in the language that you understand, but somewhere deep inside you, you do understand. Take night walks, because the gypsies used to say, the Roma gypsies, the night world is a completely different experience to the day world. What you will understand and hear and interpret and be introduced to will fulfill you and enrich your life more. And I think, to our own detriment, we're too divorced from it. And we're just going to stick our head into a phone, stick our hearts, our minds into a computer. I'm not so sure. It's got its benefits, obviously. Of course it has. But over, by and large, I think it's leaving us a bit ragged. And the soul doesn't speak to you in the neon lights. The soul needs, if the soul wants to speak to you, you need to create the environment where the soul feels that it's going to be heard. That's for all of us. We're all soul beings. I know that, you know, whatever that sounds like, but that's what I believe. That's what I experience.
Yeah.
So it's the half light. The soul will come to you in the half light. Soul will come to you in the quiet. It doesn't come to you in the harsh, rash, fast moving world that we live in. We all have to deal with it, and we do. But we need time to just come back to, essence. It's like coming home to the hearth fire, you know.
Yeah.
You know, so it's beautiful to come home and there's a fire. If you're lucky enough to have a fire, a real fire, there's nothing better to welcome you back into the hearth, you know.
Yeah.
The home of the soul, where conversation is had, relationships are built, and
I love that. The home of the soul.
Yeah. Yeah.
How beautiful is that? Home of the soul. Even just saying it, there's a yearning for somewhere.
Yeah. 100%. And that's what we're yearning for. Mm. And what's beautiful about it is that it's not for some, you know, it may be difficult to attain. It may be difficult to create because some people are really in, for majority for now, if we can create that for ourselves, we can at least take that out and try and share that with people and try and give that to them, you know. That's where it's at, really. So all that shines or glitters is not necessarily gold, is it? Even though, you know.
No, this is very true. This is very true. And also, I think one of the main things and the most important thing that I have found in my life, for sure, is to hear the voice of the heart. And people will say, oh, that's so flowery. I really don't care that it's flowery. It's actually true. Because unless we are following the dictates of our heart, we are completely lost. We don't stand a chance.
Yeah. Well, you know, and that's interesting that you say that because that's on one. No, I say this. Some people say 12 laws, or some people say it's just a law. But the overview is that in one of the laws of karma, that's one of the laws that follow your heart, follow the heart path. You know, do what is. Do what resonates in you, to your higher good and to others, you know. You got to take taking responsibility as well, because they all interweave, all these teachings, they all interweave. So take responsibility.
Yeah. Or,
you know, if you're going to create a world of chaos and harm and bad intentions, well, then how on earth could you expect there to be peace in your life? You can't. It's intrinsically linked. So, again, like going back onto the teachings, my main inspiration for yoga was Buddhism, the teachings of the Buddha, which I came across very, very fortunately when I was younger. And I was looking and I was struggling and I was like, nothing was making sense. You know, like I said, poverty and drug addictions and a lot of... disharmony, like on an extreme level, coming across the teachings of the Buddha when I was young, and I don't think it's by chance. In Buddhism, there's no such thing. And it didn't feel like that straight away. But, you know, it takes years to put into practice the teachings of the Buddha. But I looked at them and already had an overview or an understanding that something was making sense. You know, even the kind of what I thought was didn't make sense, in as much as like, why is my life like this? Why have I not got, you know, just the fundamentals of parents and stuff, you know? Like, what's that all about? And so the Buddha talks about karma, Buddha talks about responsibility, and ultimately freedom from suffering. And so that's interesting as well, because just because the Buddha mentioned suffering, he didn't mean that life is just suffering. No, he's trying to get us all to see that that's almost like the shadow side, if you want to understand it in Western terms, from a Jungian perspective. You just acknowledge the shadows, bring them to the table, and let them have their say, you know, and listen to what they've got to say, and give them a platform, and integrate it all. And then that is the path to freedom, mental freedom, you know, ultimately, because that's what it is, isn't it? It's consciousness, it's elevation of your consciousness, your energy, the way you resonate and your frequency. So all of these teachings are, and all of the practices are only concerned with that, you know, that we acquire the body first, the breath second, and the mantra and the chants and some secret initiations, and then we're on our way, you know. But staying in the marketplace of life, there's that challenge, isn't it? Staying in the marketplace where there's upset, where there's discord, where there's chaos, you know. And So bringing in the elements then that when you are in the marketplace of life, one doesn't go through blind. One equips themselves with all the skills, all the knowledge that one can. Be inspired to do that, you know? That could be from the passion of, look, I mean, you're looking for passion? Look to the flamenco dancers of Spain.
Oh,
the relationship.
I love them. Love them.
The relationship they have with their music and their movement and their expression. They begin from the shadow and they elevate to God. Look, like you said earlier, listen to the Sufi music. Sufi music is to relate you to God. You create enough space for God to come in. Whatever that is to you.
They are incredible, actually. These you talk about the love and sitting at the feet of the masters. And I, you know, thank God I have met some incredibly amazing and, you know, holy people, really, in that sense that actually when you go, it's exactly what you said, when you go and sit at their feet, yeah, I don't have anything to say, because I have all these questions. But as soon as I sat at the feet of the master, there was nothing for me to say. It all seemed totally irrelevant.
Yeah.
There was nothing to say. It was ludicrous. And I was opening my mouth on many occasions to say something, and nothing was coming out, because they are a reflection of the divine.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, don't you? You know, when you're in the presence of someone who is highly elevated, because there's no pretentiousness. There's not the big, I am this, and I need to tell you who I am.
No.
They are actually the most humble people living in the most humblest ways, who actually remind you of the divinity within yourself. And that is the true saint.
Yes. Yes, beautiful. And when I was younger, my early teenage years, I came across, it's funny you say that, because I came across a teacher, a yogi that still inspires me, and I still see his face in my mind, was the Sri Ramana Maharishi. He was the reason. You just touch something, you only need to look at his face. Dr. Paul Bunton is the famous writer that brought him to the West's attention. There were others that did that. But Dr. Paul Bunton's writing on the secrets of Egypt, the secrets of India, that was the kind of book I came across. And then he found his yogi in Sri Ramana Maharishi. And Sri Ramana was an unorthodox yogi. He never had any formal training. He didn't belong to any school. He never had any lineage. As a 14-year-old boy, he just appeared in Arunachala and just sat down and meditated in a loincloth. And that was it at 14. And everyone just congregated around him, you know, bit by bit. This is strange little boy. Sat in Padmasana meditation, no say a word. So nothing. No teachings as such. And then they built the ashram literally around him. Now, going back to that frequency and that relationship to the wheel, to the environment. This yogi, well documented, his life became very well documented. And what you can see documentary on him now on the internet. Back in our day, you had to source the books. They weren't available. These books were not available anywhere except in one particular bookshop in London. You know, you had to make an effort to find them. And then you only had the written word and a couple of blurry pictures.
Which bookshop? Not the one in Charing Cross Road.
Yes, it was Watkins, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And so going in there at 17, 18 was like entering into a Harry Potter
bookshop
back in the day. It's esoteric knowledge. Wow, it's Madame Blavatsky, it's Rudolf Steiner. It was, you know, the Sufis, is the Rubaiyat, Omar Khayyam, and many others. It's Gurdjieff again.
He's so interesting. Gurdjieff, have you read his book, Meetings with Remarkable Men?
Yes. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Fantastic book.
Yeah, brilliant book. Mm. So yeah, and then so yeah, so being introduced to all those possibilities, you know, just God, wow, you know, all this learning, and then all this revelation. So we're really fortunate. But the Maharishi caught my imagination because, one, like you said earlier, he didn't chase anything. People came to him. They built him an ashram. And he used to meditate on the beacon of light, the mountain that overlooks Arunachala, and in a cave. And he was often frequented by a tiger. The tiger would sit outside his cave whilst the yogi meditated inside. This is well documented. This is like in the late, like 1920s and what have you, early 1900s.
Mm.
So it's not way, way, way back. And but this, the whole relationship between the yogi and the tiger, what would that be? That would be that the tiger is relating to him in some way, that he knows that he's held in a space of, I think the word would be dignity. Yeah. That's what we don't give animals enough. We don't give animals enough dignity. And I think just this beautiful, beautiful human being was able to hold his steadiness. And you're talking about courage. And there's some people, again, on this yoga path and on the martial arts path, they don't, it's not enough deep enough considerations that, oh, I'll just meditate and it's all flowers. No. Wait. Let's go back. When you're meditating, when you're sitting down to meditate, and now just imagine that a tiger appears. Now, are you going to hold your nerve? Are you going to be able to sit in Padmasana and just take some deep breaths, set your mind, your energy, your whole being into just holding your ground? Now we talk about, that's courage. That's true courage. It's easy to lash out at people. It's easy to fire arrows at people and blame people and the violence that we see manifest in the world, being gangsters and getting some whatever. That's easy. That's an easy way out. No. I'm talking about the steadfastness of a yogi that has a big, can you imagine the first time that tiger frequented his cave? You're going to hold your ground, or are you going to lose the plot? So for me, that qualifies him in many ways. He was unorthodox because he touched animals. Back in the day, yogis were not supposed to be anywhere near animals. Isn't that odd? He had animals in and out of his ashram all the time. Dogs sitting with him and goats and what have you, cows. They just come in, wander around. He touched them. They sit with him. So beautiful. That to me is a yogi. And anybody that came could come and sit with him in his presence. And Dr. Paul Brunton writes about him, like I said, extensively. And that's the reason why he himself took upon himself to travel into the deeper aspects of yoga. Yoga and beyond yoga, you know. So that's just one of my inspirations from when I was very young, and still is today. If I need to think of someone's face that reminds me of dignity and beauty and grace and wisdom, it's the Maharishi. And he's famous for one, turn the question around and ask yourself, who are you? Who am I? Sit with that for your life. Don't ask anything else. Just sit and ask yourself, who am I? Let that unfold. Allow that to unravel. And then one will discover that their true consciousness, their true nature, the nature of their true consciousness, you know.
And who am I?
Who am I? Yeah. He was the yogi that had his students just sit and ask yourself, who am I? You know?
Wow, that's a big question.
It's a big question. And Dr. Paul Brunton was the first one to say that he went there with a textbook of questions, and he finally got an audience with him, but not an audience as you imagine. He had to sit and wait for days in with him. Mm. He had gone. The yogi was somewhere else. The yogi was traveling through universes, worlds that the normal person doesn't have access to. And he had to just wait for this yogi to come back round. That's how it is, you know. And he wasn't just wasting his time. As far as I'm concerned, like people say, well, what a waste of a life. These lamas or the Wimpaches, the great Milarepas and, you know, the great Buddhas and the great yogis. Well, what's the point of living that kind of life? What's the point is they change our consciousness. They help us change our consciousness. They keep us, they help us remember, recall that that's what we have the potential to be, which is basically an arahant or a Buddha. Not to harm anything. Try your best not to harm anything. Any living thing, try your best. We all make mistakes, and that's the teachings of the profundity of Buddha teachings. We could go on for, we don't have enough lifetime to explain it all, but fundamental is try your best. So his idea of compassion as well, compassion is living with your shadow side. Compassion just doesn't just mean, oh, I'm going to be kind. Compassion is so deep, it's so vast, it's endless. One must understand, at least have some kind of inkling, insight into their own makeup, be able to truly practice compassion. That comes then naturally arising. It doesn't come from being full. It doesn't come from reading any text. It doesn't come from dogma. When one feels that depth in your being, well, then how can you not feel for all living things? It just comes hand in hand. It starts to entwine itself. Do you know what I mean? And you see and understand suffering of all sentient beings. And the possibility of what? That great word? Liberation, isn't it? Liberation. Yes. From. So
yes.
That's not just a promise, that's an experience. That's not a promise. Mm. One lives on hope. And that's a popular word, you know. There's always hope. Well, flip that over and hope is despair. I don't want to live in despair. I want to live in internal experiential knowledge. Do you understand? Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
So I'm not clinging on to hope. I'm not clinging to hope that everything will prevail to the good. No, you have to make it. You have to work at it. You have to discipline. That's why I say discipline is freedom. Without discipline, there's no freedom. And we live in a society, we go back to your point earlier, one of the effects I'm seeing around me over the last, say, 20 years in particular, is that with the access of internet and things, we're bypassing a lot of things that we no longer consider to be important. And one of those things is discipline. There's no freedom without discipline. You can't just expect everything to fall on your lap. Entitlement, I want so I can have. There's nothing learned. There's nothing gained from that, except that we just end up, you know, floundering. And I find that that's the really, really important element. And that's why what appeals to me is that one, whatever your discipline is, you must discipline yourself to train in it as much as you can. Because in discipline, like I said, is the beginnings of freedom. You can't have it the other way around. I don't think so. You know, you start off ragged. You start off cutting corners. You start off expecting everything to be put in your lap. You're in for a big disappointment. And anyway, why would you want to live like that anyway? Because it's not really going to do you much, you know, much good in the long run. So discipline in every aspect of life. That doesn't mean like you have to be severe. You bring a kindness and a compassion into that, but it does mean that you have a practice. It does mean that you dedicate yourself to X amount of hours a week to your practice, whatever that may be, to maintain your insights and your frequencies, and to help you through when life and its vicissitudes hit you hard. You know, you have the skills or you have the knowledge and the wherewithal to kind of like travel the path when it's difficult, you know. Coming off the path, I've met so many people in my life that have come off the so-called pathless path, if you know what I mean. And they never get back. They never get back on. for me, that's it's nothing to do with me in the great scheme of things. Everyone's living their lives, they've got their karma to live, but it just is like, that's sad. That's a bit sad, just a little bit sad, you know?
It's a lot sad. It's very sad. But what you've said, there's so much profound wisdom in everything that you have said, Kevin. And this discipline is something that is absolutely correct.
Yeah.
Because the world sells you freedom. But in fact, people think if they can do what they want to do, when they want to do it, and how they want to do it, that they are actually free. That, in any case, is a false sense of freedom. That is an entrapment. That's
You're totally
prison.
Right. Yeah. I totally agree. And Jordan Peterson's recently saying about, okay, let's put it like this. We can have whatever we want when we want. So he uses this as an example. So say it's just in the sex realm. And says, you can have sex whenever you want, with who you want, however you want, and no one can tell me otherwise. You're on the path to hell. It's just an example. I could use myriad examples, but that's the path to hell.
Yeah.
You're on a quick road to hell. You will be abused. You will abuse. You'll be distrusted. You won't trust. You'll lose your confidence. You'll lose your balance. It's just an example of extremity and indulging in it all the time. And that is the message from a lot of about society. You know, you can have what you want when you want, and no consideration of your impact and your influence on those around you. That's not the way to be, you know what I mean? It just isn't. It leads, like you said, it leads to nowhere but a dead end. And you're just going to be spiritually exhausted as well. You're just going to be lost. You're going to be bereft. You know, there's no room
people
for
say, don't they? I want to do what I want to do.
Yes,
I'm not saying that people should be under a dictatorship. This is not what I'm saying.
No,
saying a balance, because the balance between the ego and the soul. The ego loves to be number one. Yeah. It wants to parade on the street with feathers galore. The soul is more humble, but unless you have that balance, which is, I think, the journey of life. It's not something that comes easily. You know, you were talking about these great yogis and all these very, very highly spiritual people. And reaching this level of consciousness and this level where they went in the world, but not of the world. And you can only reach that, I believe, where you have discipline, because that's why they go into seclusions. That's why they're not just walking on fire because of the fact of, you know, it's a nice party trick. I mean, really walking through the fire, is something completely different. You know, you have to have control over the ego. The ego has to be subservient. You've got to give it rights. It's got to eat, it's got to drink, it's got to have its cake. And
it's one of the guests at the table,
But it's not to ride you.
No.
You have to ride your donkey, as all the, you know, spiritual masters say. You must ride the donkey. You must hold the reins of that donkey. Otherwise, as you said, it will take you down a very bad path.
Yeah, most of the time you see that. You see that manifest a lot of the time. And that's at the root. That's what we say, the Buddha's teaching is the root of suffering, isn't it? And so the bullock leading the cart, other than the other way around, should be the other way around most of the time. And like you said, the ego has a place like everything. But then one would ask, sometimes just consider, well, ask yourself that question as well. If you ask yourself, who am I? From time to time, ask yourself that question. Don't expect the answer straight away, but just ruminate with it, sit with it, explore it. And I find
make it your life mission to find out.
Make it your life mission. Because if you turn your gaze inwards, well, who are you? Where are you? Where's the I that's so important? Can you take it out and put it on the table? No. Okay. Well, in that case, then, what is this experience of being? Where is it coming from? If I'm not solid and the I ultimately doesn't exist. Wow. Okay. Mm. Well, I need to kind of like start reconsidering a few things here. Do you know what I mean? It's much more mysterious than I ever imagined. It's much more profound. Now, could it be, when the Buddha suggests the luminosity of mind, one mind, hang on a minute, one mind what? Shiva mind or Buddha mind, that's what that means, ultimately. But then we're all at different stages. But that, if one just even considers that, it's like, wait a minute, what he's pointing towards or what he's suggesting is kind of like mind-blowing. Literally, one mind. What does the Buddha mean by that? Mm. What could he mean by that? You know? So, yeah, everything has its place, doesn't it?
Yes.
Everything within reason. And be quick to judge anything. Be quick to go the other way. Be quick to say, okay, I'll consider that. My thoughts. How weird are they? My feelings, my emotions, my body, my mind, my perceptions. Every now and again, I don't have time for that. If you don't have time for that, you don't have time for your life then. You're trying to be outside your life all the time. Mm. And I think, like I said, I think to our detriment, you know, and I think right at this juncture, I do think that we need a spiritual practice wherever that manifests for you. Mm. We need to bring back the sacred, we need to bring back the heart. We need to bring back potential. What's the word? Fecundity. We need to bring back that potential. We need to bring back potential for have the courage to let everything go so that we can see things clearly. And that's an everyday, you know. And just when you're getting hemmed in by your own mind, by your own thoughts, pending when you're getting stuck, when you're getting anxious, when you're getting depressed, to see how that helps now, all of a sudden, who am I? And what's the reality of these thoughts and these emotions and these feelings? How real are they? So if I'm just experiencing just energy, now we're going on a different level, so that comes through the practice and the application of the practices of yoga and martial arts. Now I'm experiencing just pure energy. Now if I don't word that energy, now I'm just sitting with it. Now it's an energy that's completely universal. It's not personal. Oh, hang on a minute. I may be touching on something that is ultimately going to free me. If I have just a minute of that insight, just one time, that instead of labeling it good or bad, right, wrong, I don't do any of that. I sit in meditation, I leave my thoughts alone. The mind thinks, leave it alone. It's designed to think. Okay, leave your mind alone. Don't invest in the positive or the negative or the neutral thinking. It's just thinking. Be compassionate when you say that. You're sitting, it's just thinking. Ah, I can let go. What do you let go into? Into more luminosity, into more understanding. Now, again, and how many times did you have to do that? People ask me this all the time. But my mind's so active, I can't meditate. Sit and leave your mind alone. That's the first thing. Then listen with your inner ear. Start to listen. Easiest way to do it, you know? Don't have to formulate it. Don't have to have this big kind of like big deal about things. Sit and leave things alone. Just leave. Leave it alone, you know? What arises is pure energy, you know? The same energy and the same mechanisms when we're experiencing fear. Exactly the same happens as when we're experiencing ecstasy. Now, if you can remember that, you take the mystery and the power out of fear itself, and we're living in a lot of fear at present. Now, we need to do that as well, because we can diffuse that straight away by understanding that. The physiology of fear is the same physiology as excitement, the same phenomenon. Just take a moment out and let your heart beat fast. Let the blood move quicker through your veins. You know, feel the shingles in your skin, what have you. And just be patient. Just wait. You know, this is the same phenomena. When I'm excited, do I oppose those feelings? Do I oppose that physiology and the mind? No, because I'm enjoying what I'm doing. But when we're not, now it's all, alarm goes off. What? I'm anxious. It's the same thing. The only thing that's changed is your thinking. Now, so like I'm saying, so leave your thinking alone. Just observe it. Don't get involved in it. Leave it alone. And they'll just, thoughts will just drift through your mind. They'll come and they'll go. They'll come and they'll go. Sit back and listen. You know? Ease yourself into your presence, in your essence. Watch it all. And then it becomes very, very interesting. You can use your curiosity to inquire now. Ah, okay. It's like watching a film. I thought I was the main star. I'm not. Do you know what I mean? I can pull myself back from him and it can play out again. But I'm not involved in it. There you are. You're almost there. You're almost, hang on. Is this the trick? Is this the trick that I played on myself? My little ego trick. You know what I mean? For many, many, many lifetimes. That this isn't malleable. This isn't something I can kind of like re-engage with in a different way. This life story that we call it, you know? This is the route to freedom, isn't it?
Indeed. Then
just unfolding and it just all manifests and not taking it too seriously or personally because it's not real. You know? But something's real. Your consciousness is real. Your consciousness is eternal. And we know that. We know that. Don't ask me how. We're born knowing it. Some may switch off to that. Some may struggle with that. Some may never want to open up to that. That's their karma and that's their life. That's their what they are. Maybe they're not ready. I don't know. It sounds. I'm not saying that some people are ready and we're better. I don't mean that at all. Or, you know, maybe circumstances will bring it about in them. An awakening or something, because it often does for people, but in extreme circumstances and bang, they're into a different way of understanding, way of perception, way of seeing things, and more importantly, experiencing energy.
We're all on a different path at a different time.
Yes.
And even that is predestined.
Yeah. Yeah, we all got that part to play. And so sometimes you can be the great seer, you can be the poet, you can be, you can be the rogue, you can be it all, but just know that you choose it. Now it's different. Ah, my consciousness has chosen it for whatever reason. Oh, okay. I'm playing this. This is an unfolding. This is a play. Now, just play. Go and play, you know? And then most importantly, when you're playing, you realize that what's important, we go right back to the beginning of the conversation, bring in the qualities that make your heart sing. So it's music, isn't it? So it's,
yes.
It could be poetry. It could be love, true love and connection to nature. It could be what you do. Make sure that what you do, one of the laws of karma again, try and make it that is the most joyful thing you can think of every single day. This then bring about an influence, you know. Hopefully, some people will be positively influenced by that. They'll see it manifest. You know, does that make sense?
It's so beautiful. I could listen to that for hours because when someone is speaking truly from their heart, you know it. You feel it. It resonates. It's a different vibration. It's a different level of being. And that's where I'm sure you took people out there, because you certainly took me to that level of appreciation. Understanding is a big word, but I appreciated and it resonated. It rung true. And I think that is the sign of someone who has truly walked the path and walked through the fire, danced with the stars, and is now back on the earth helping people find their way. So I'm really grateful, Kevin, and
thank you very much,
that you're jewels of wisdom.
Thank you very much for sharing. And you know, we shared something, didn't we? It's beautiful. And you know.
Very beautiful, and the sun is setting, and I think about what you said now, where what the gypsies say, some of the wisest people on the planet, I must say, the night is another world.
Yes. Yeah. It's time for the goddess to come and teach her wisdom.
Absolutely beautiful. My goodness. You have to write a book.
Maybe
can you imagine this book? You have to write it. It's something that should be on your to-do list.
Thank you.
For sure. And before you go, please tell people where they can find out more about you, a website, or where can they contact you even?
It's Kevin Silas at Peaceful Path, www.peacefulpathyoga.com.
Okay. Right. And can anyone contact you?
Anyone can contact me, yes. Yes.
Okay. All right.
And like I would just like to say to you earlier before we went on air, I'm not one big on, fanciful sites and stuff. So, but yes, people can contact and yeah.
It doesn't matter. I mean, John Lewis and Sainsbury's has a fancy site, but that doesn't mean anything. All the best things are hidden, Kevin, as you know.
Yeah.
But thank you. Please thank come you. Again. I would love you to come again.
Yeah, it feels like, you know, thank you so much for the opportunity. And it does feel like we're literally just touching on the surface. We're just getting going. But yeah. Time.
Thank you. Have a great rest of the evening.
You too.
And I wish you all the best. And whenever you like, you're very welcome.
Thank you.
Look all right then.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
Kevin Silas. Extraordinary conversation. And I just want to say really that so many of my guests have the most incredible stories. Thank you so much for joining me today. Until next time, take the chance, take the leap of faith, and live your dreams. Take care and lots of love.
Thank you for listening to Secrets for an Inspirational Life, brought to you by your host, Mimi Novick. Please remember to subscribe to the podcast and see you in the next episode. For more information about Mimi Novick and her books, music, and inspirational work, take a look at her website, www.miminovick.co.uk.